This is the fourth day of this October 2007 seven-day session. We will resume reading from the teachings of Bodhidharma and or his contemporaries. This is from a book called The Bodhidharma Anthology, The Earliest Records of Zen by Jeffrey Broughton. You remember from yesterday that there were seven texts that make up this Bodhidharma anthology, and we're now on the fifth one in, wait a minute. Yeah, the fifth one, which is the record one. He's calling it record number one. And there's a record two and a record three. And it's in the form of questions and answers. And we don't know who the questioner or the answerers are in this. Mostly. Question. In cultivating and attaining the path, are some slow and some quick? Cultivating, by the way, basically means practice. Practicing and attaining the path. Are some slow and some quick? Answer. They are separated by millions of eons. In the case of those for whom mind is the path, it is quick. For those practitioners who produce the thought of enlightenment and practice, it is slow. Well, the difference being that the latter group, those who produce the thought of enlightenment and practice, are dividing this mind that is really indivisible, and setting up this this goal or this point B that we need to get to from this point A and along this route called practice. Whereas in the former group, those for whom mind is the path, is here we could say it's understanding that everything is this mind, therefore there is nowhere to go, there's nothing to get. He goes on, people of sharp abilities know that mind is the path. People of dull abilities seek everywhere for the path, but lack knowledge of its location. Moreover, they do not know that mind from the outset is unexcelled, perfect enlightenment. Question, what about quickly attaining the path? Answer, mind is the substance of the path, and so one quickly attains the path. When the practitioner himself realizes that delusion has arisen, then, relying on Dharma, he gazes and brings about its exhaustion. Gazes here. Let me say that this is, I've come to feel that the translation of this material is not great, but it's the only translation we have of this material. On the first day, on the first teisho of the sesshin, I was reading from another text in this anthology, but with a different translator, Red Pine. But this material is new. I don't know of any other translation. So we'll just have to do a little interpreting here. He gazes, I would say sits. He sits, does zazen, and brings about its exhaustion, brings about the exhaustion of delusion. how do you bring about the exhaustion of delusion? You get out of the way. You don't consort with delusion. You don't fight it. You don't make a problem out of it. Delusion meaning all of the random, irrelevant thoughts that surface when we're doing zazen. You don't engage with it. You just leave it alone and put all of your attention in the practice, the koan or the breath, and then it runs its course. It exhausts itself. Question: how is mind the substance of the path? Answer: mind is unconscious like trees or stones. It is as if there were someone who painted dragons and tigers with his own hand, and yet, upon looking at them, became frightened. Deluded people are also like this. The brush of thought and consciousnesses paints razor mountains and sword forests. These are certain Buddhist hells. The brush of thought and consciousnesses paints razor mountains and sword forests, and yet it is thought and the consciousnesses that fear them. One way you can understand this is makyo. Makyo are just are hallucinations and other disturbances of the mind and the body, that these are self-created. The brush of mind and the consciousnesses discriminates and draws forms, sounds, smells, tastes, and touches, and upon looking at them in turn, produces greed, anger, and stupidity. Sometimes it is fascinated and sometimes repelled. Due to the discriminations of thought, mind, and the consciousnesses, various sorts of karma are in turn produced. If you can realize that thought and the consciousnesses from the outset have been void quiescent, and also avoid seeing the locus of the arising of thought and the consciousnesses, then you are cultivating the path. See into the emptiness of the five skandhas, what we chant in the Prajnaparamita: form, feeling, thought, consciousness. Some, by discriminations of their own mind, draw tigers, wolves, lions, poisonous dragons, evil spirits, the generals of the five paths of rebirth, King Yama, the ox-headed guards of hell, and the hell of the sound of cold. These things are discriminated by their own minds, but they are then controlled by these things, and so they undergo various sufferings. There are all kinds of other ways that we do this. If we're sitting and thinking about some relationship that we have, either a romantic relationship or some other kind of a working relationship at work, then we become controlled by these things. And to one degree or another, we suffer because of our trafficking in these discriminations, these thoughts and images and memories. We paint these pictures in our minds, and then we come under their spell. He goes on, realize that whatever mind discriminates is merely forms. If you awaken to the fact that mind from the outset has been void quiescent and know that mind is not itself a form, then mind is unconnected. Maybe detached would be better there. Forms are not forms. They are constructed in the manner of an illusion by your own mind. If you merely realize that they are not real, then you will attain liberation. It took me many years of practice to realize that if there is any form of any kind in the mind, then that's not where you want to be. Any two-ness, any discrimination of this or that, of any kind. If you can think in terms of this and that, that's the realm of form. And in terms of Zazen, that's not where we want to be. There's a footnote here I just noticed. That what I've been reading now since Taisho began, he says in the footnote that this seems to be a Wei Ke section. Wei Ke was Bodhidharma's successor. He was the guy who stood out in the snow and cut off his arm, supposedly, and became his successor. So the translator, who is a scholar, has reasons to believe that this section is by Wei Ke. Here is just a straight discourse. It's not a question and answer. When at present you rely on the Dharma's three treasures of Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha to carry out the path, you must not have such views as good, bad, like, dislike, cause, effect, is not. Holding the precepts, breaking the precepts, and so forth. If you make these sorts of calculations, they are all delusions manifested by your own mind. You will not notice that the realm of objects arises from your own mind. If you hold that no dharmas exist, that is, that fundamentally all things are no thing, it is also a delusion manifested by your own mind. That is, to the degree that it's a thought, a concept in your mind. The perceptions of your own mind are all deluded thoughts that construct is and is not. If you say that the wisdom of the Buddhas surpasses all, it is also a delusion manifested by your own mind. One's own mind, in the manner of a sleight of hand, constructs both existence and non-existence, and in turn is deluded by them. Now, these categories, is and is not, and these other ones, I think people often are trafficking in these dualisms without knowing it. If you put an I there, I am or I am not, this is something that everyone can relate to. I am making progress, I am doing well, I am so forth, all of that. That's all is and is not. not to mention good, bad, like, dislike. This is the these are the things that just rush in to fill the mind every step of the way if we're not vigilant and catch it, notice it, and go back to the practice. In the Dharma of cultivating the path, the vital energy of those who obtain their understanding through the medium of the written word is weak. If one obtains his understanding from events, his vital energy will be robust. I take this to mean, when he says events, I think we can take this as experience, direct experience, living change, adapting to circumstances and so forth. Those who see Dharma from the medium of events never lose mindfulness anywhere. When those whose understanding is from the medium of the written word encounter events, their eyes are beclouded. To discuss events from the point of view of the sutras and treatises is to be estranged from Dharma. So it's reading and discussing the living experience rather than just directly experiencing it. Though one may chat about events and listen concerning events, it is not as potent as personally experiencing events with the body and mind. The body, not just the mind, the body. So much of practice comes down to being in our bodies. That's how we can ensure that we're present at any given moment. With the mind, we can go all kinds of places and all different times, the future and past, but the body is always present. That's why true Zazen is basically a physical experience. If it isn't, then there's a split, there's something off. If you find that you're bogged down in thoughts, then you can, during Kinhin, say, you can just lay aside your regular practice and just as you're walking, feel the contact of your feet and the floor. The soles of your feet and the carpet, just put your mind there and feel that the physicality of it. Or if you're getting a drink of water, feel that the cup, the glass against your lips, and then the water as you swallow, washing your hands in the sink. These things always, to the degree that we're really mindful of these physical things, we will be brought back to just this very present moment. If someone's understanding that events are Dharma is deep, then worldly people will not be able to fathom him. Even if the practitioner time and again has his belongings stolen by thieves, he will not have a mind of attachment and will not even be vexed. If he is time and again cursed and slandered by others, he will not be vexed. If one is like this, his mind of the path will gradually strengthen. It will accumulate over years without end until he spontaneously has no mind toward any disagreeable and agreeable thing. Therefore, he who is not bound up with events can be called the Bodhisattva of great power. If one wishes to make the mind of cultivating the path robust, he should send mind outside the boundaries of the norms. And that fosters a question. But first, a little bit more about this. Well, really, this last passage is echoing the first of first two of Bodhidharma's four practices, which, remember, the first is the practice of requiting injury, that is, being aware that when one suffers fortune or misfortune, that it is the effect of previous causes. And the second is adapting to conditions and not getting swept away by either joy or self-pity. But this last sentence, where the author says he should send mind outside the boundaries of the norms. Question: what events are outside the boundaries of the norms? Answer: the spontaneously peaceful mind does not realize the understanding of the Mahayana or the Hinayana, does not produce the thought of enlightenment, even to the point of not wishing for the omniscience of a Buddha, does not honor the person who is accomplished in samadhi, does not disdain the person who is attached in craving, even to the point of not wishing for Buddha wisdom. One does not grasp for understanding, key word there is grasp, and does not seek wisdom, he will desire to avoid the delusions and confusions of the Dharma masters and Dhyana masters. What he's really saying here is not to get fixed on anything or anyone, not to stake one's practice on things or individuals. He goes on, if one can preserve mind and erect will, entertain no wish to be a worthy or a sage, not seek liberation, fear neither the cycle of birth and death nor the hells, and with no mind directly carry out his responsibilities, then for the first time he will bring to perfection a dull mind of norms. This dull mind of norms is the ordinary way of reacting to conditions, people of all kinds. If one can see all the transformations of the worthies and sages due to their supernormal powers through hundreds and thousands of eons without producing a desirous mind, then this person will desire to avoid the deceptions and delusions of others. Well, one way to understand this, one of many ways, is in terms of our tendency to put teachers and others, celebrities and people in power, to put them on pedestals. He's warning us not to do this. Another question: how does one produce the state of being outside the boundaries of the norms? Answer: the Confucian virtues of humaneness, righteousness, ritual, wisdom, and faith are called the mind within the boundaries of the norms. Within the boundaries of the norms. Birth and death and nirvana are also called the mind within the boundaries of the norms. If you wish to go outside the boundaries of the norms, that is, outside worldly values and concerns, to the point of jettisoning the terms common man and sage, you must not know through having a method. You must not know through not having a method. You must not know through both having a method and not having a method. That which ordinary knowledge understands is also said to be within the boundaries of the norms. So he's talking here about our conventional notions about everything. It's good to do that. It's right to do that. It's wrong to do that. I'm a good person. She's a bad person. This is right. That's wrong. When you do not produce the mind of the common man, the hearer or bodhisattva mind, and do not even produce a Buddha mind or any mind at all, then for the first time you can be said to have gone outside the boundaries of the norms. We could say in terms of Zazen, this is not to imagine these states of Buddhas or Bodhisattvas or enlightenment or right and wrong, not to discriminate in this way, but to dwell in no mind. That is, in the koan or the breath, shikantaza. If you desire that no mind at all arise, that you do not produce understanding nor give rise to delusion, then for the first time you can be said to have gone outside of everything. When the worldly morons encounter a devilish cock and bull fellow who babbles a demonic line, they come up with a demonic interpretation and use it as a compass. This is beneath comment. How can they perform the function of a great thing? Hearing that a certain person leads a group of millions, their mind is triggered into motion. Gaze well at the dharmas of your own mind to determine whether it harbors the spoken and written word or not. That's a good one. Gaze well at the dharmas, the things of your own mind, to determine whether it harbors the spoken and written word or not. It's your mind at any moment. Is your mind free of thoughts and concepts or not? Question: what is the mind of plainness? What is the mind of ingenious artifice? Answer: spoken and written words are called ingenious artifice. Forms and formlessness are equal. Walking, standing, sitting, or lying, all behavior and activity are plainness, even to the extent that when one encounters any sorrowful or joyful event, the mind remains immobile. That, for the first time, can be called the mind of plainness. Here again, notice he links this mind of plainness, or another translation probably would be the ordinary mind. There's the famous dialogue where Zhao Zhou asked Nan Xuan, What is the way? And Nanchuan said, ordinary mind is the way. Another translation for that is everyday mind or normal mind. That's what this questioner is asking about. What is the mind of plainness? When I read this, spoken and written words are called ingenious artifice. I think of all the ways that people in public office and in the media, how cleverly they can spin things with ingenious artifice. There's such a hunger in this country for politicians who will speak plainly, directly, honestly. But we're in this bind where to do so pretty much would sink the chances of such a politician. People want that, but then when they get it, then everyone will find fault with them by what they said. It's become this this ridiculous game of spin and avoiding being pinned down and trying to please everyone. Question, what is called correct and what is called false? Answer, having no mental discrimination is called correct, and having the mind interpret dharmas is called false. When you come to the point of being unaware of both false and correct, that for the first time can be called correct. The sutra says, we don't know which sutra, those who abide in the correct path do not discriminate whether it is false or correct. Having no mental discrimination is called correct. How rare that is, those moments are in our zazen when there is no discrimination happening at all. This is a state of sublime purity of mind. There are no categories in the mind. There's no this or that. It's just this. It's interesting that many of these questions are framed as categories, and the author of this, whether it's Weka or someone else, goes ahead and answers them, kind of explains in more modern Zen, in the Zen of Wei Nung. And it would be more common to not even engage on that level with the person, because to do so is to risk just furthering that habit of discriminating between this and that. This is an older style. This is the early Chan of Bodhidharma and his immediate successors. It's it reflects more the Indian mind and the Indian influence, where words are used more. The Chinese came to emphasize more the demonstrations or the concrete, rather than being drawn into these discussions. Still, I'm taken at the level it is. This is basic Zen understanding of teaching. Question. Worldly people apply themselves to various sorts of learning. Why do they fail to obtain the path? Answer. Because they see a self, they do not obtain the path. If they were able to avoid seeing a self, then they would obtain the path. Self means ego. The reason why the sage meets suffering without being sad and encounters pleasure without being happy is that he does not see a self. The reason why he has neither suffering nor pleasure is that he has lost self. When you attain to emptiness, even the self is lost. So what further thing can there be that is not lost? In the world, how many can there be who have lost self? If you can lose self, everything from the outset will be non-existent. The self arbitrarily produces calculations, and then one is affected by birth, aging, sickness, death, sadness, commiseration, suffering, defilements, cold, heat, wind, rain, and everything that is not in accord with one's wishes. These are all manifestations of false thought. In the manner of a magician's sleight of hand, departing to another birth and staying in this birth are not under the control of a self. Why? Arbitrarily, the ego of worldly people produces resistance and opposition, and they fail to acknowledge that departing and staying are not under the control of the ego. The defilements exist because of the grasping of the self, and from this springs departing and staying. If you know that departing and staying are not under the control of the self, then for you, mine will be a sleight of hand dharma incapable of holding you back. If you do not resist sleight of hand dharmas, then no matter what may come, you will not be hindered. If you are capable of not resisting transformations, then no matter what may happen, you will have nothing to repent of. This phrase, when the self is lost, I think it can be misleading. A much better way, I think, to put it is when you see through the self, when you see the illusory nature of the self, when you see that what we call the self is just an aggregate, a bunch of memories and images and thoughts. This is the self. And what is there? What substance is there to memories, thoughts, images? None at all. True self is no self. And this passage here, where he talks about the departing and staying are not under the control of the self. This is the biggest humiliation to the ego is this realization that we can't control these things. We can't control, ultimately, when we get sick, when we get injured, when we die. And more than that, we can't control the mind, really. Really, we can't. It's not a matter of controlling it. That's not our object in Zazen. It's to relinquish the illusion of control. And then we find ourselves in harmony with the self nature, with conditions, with circumstances. We don't have to control things when we accept them and are in harmony with them. Our practice, whatever our individual practice is just a way for us to get out of the way. I don't have to do anything. There is no I to do anything here. This is not a project that we have to do. It's non-doing. It's stepping back into our practice. This is where things happen on their own. Things fall into place. The mind settles. And all is seen in its true nature. It's not a matter of doing or remaking or repairing or problem solving, but just seeing differently. Seeing means understanding. We don't have to fix anything. We just have to see everything as it is. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.